Since Gina did, this is our first time hearing her at the conference. She spoke in Toronto over Shabbos, but just to briefly introduce her, we heard her back in March. She was in Toronto, and we were very impressed, and we invited her back now to come. She is, as she just told me, she has submitted her PhD thesis on tax and commercial law in Israel. She's waiting to get her official PhD, then next time we'll call her a doctor. But she teaches law at Bar Ilan and Haifa University and at Sapir College in Sderot. She's taught at Stern, at many, many of the seminaries in Israel, combining expertise both in tax and, of course, in Jewish studies. And it's a pleasure to have her here. And Rav Shurlo, we met last night. I just want to mention the founder of Tzohar, very important rabbinic organization in Israel, and doing lots of very important work in terms of opening up the non-religious public to the beauty of Torah and to deal with them in a refined way, marriages and life cycle events and education, etc., etc. And of course, serves as the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat in Petah Tikva. And it's a pleasure to have them. They're going to be talking here together on a Jewish dream of peace. Bakasha. Thank you very much. It is going to be in English, even though, you know.
Good morning. This session will be a different session, a different kind of session. We're not going to make two presentations, but we are going to have a chavrusa, and not equally. I'll be the one that is asking the questions and expressing his opinions through the questions. You'll be able to understand exactly what do I mean by my questions. And I think that it's a really great opportunity to hear Pnina's answers. First of all, I never heard them. Okay? It's not a game. I never heard them, and it's very important for me. But it's really a great opportunity to... I'll be short. She'll be long. But two of us will say things in different kind of things. And then at one point will be... we'll feel that the audience will take part. It's a base midrash. And if anyone wants to say any comments, it's an intimate place, so we are not standing and we're sitting, and I'm really going to ask her very, very difficult questions, and I'll express my opinions through those questions. And I'll start with the first one, and the first one is the following. Is it dangerous? I'll ask a question that is based on facts and on trying to commentate this fact or two, and to say something through the facts. First of all, do you agree that it's very dangerous inside of the Zionist religious society to adopt lefty opinions? And if it's dangerous, if you agree with the facts, what do you think about it?
Oh, you're already. Yeah, I'm trying to verify the question because I haven't heard the question. Not only did Rav Shlomo not hear the answers, I didn't hear the question. Dangerous?
Yeah.
You think it's dangerous?
You'll be isolated.
Adopt?
You'll be isolated. You'll be attacked. People will say you are a traitor. Whatever.
Okay, so I'll tell you what I think is dangerous. I think it's dangerous versus.
Can you clarify what you mean by left?
Yeah, left opinion means trying to achieve peace with the Palestinians and willing to withdraw from the West Bank to transfer settlements and to at least unify them and take small settlements and move them to a big area. I mean, these are, and what in Israel has been considered as center, in our society, it's a very, very extreme left-wing position.
So we're focusing politics-wise only, meaning not left in terms of hashkafa, we're saying.
Yeah.
I'll say what I think is dangerous, but again, I'm expressing my personal opinion. I'm not representing anything but myself here. I think it's very dangerous for any society, definitely for religious Zionism, to have only one message which applies one-size-fits-all kind of a thing, especially in a postmodern generation where everyone is entitled to their own opinion and still can be affiliated with a certain community or with a certain society. I think it is very dangerous that in religious Zionism we haven't yet reached that stage where it is legitimate to have more streams within, again, under that big umbrella of religious Zionism. That by itself, I think, is dangerous for that society, because in a sense it does not allow for an open discussion for people to really think through their messages, the ideology that they have been grown, have been educated to believe in from day one. That, I think, is very, very dangerous. At the very same time, I do think that things are changing in religious Zionism, definitely in the past 10 or 15 years. Now, I'm not sure whether things are changing in religious Zionism or whether I'm changing. Maybe I'm growing, so I'm seeing, I'm exposed to more things that have been existent before, but I simply was not aware of them. And I will provide a few examples. For example, when I was growing up in Akiva, you know, it's very obvious back then, you know, 16 years ago, by the way, the day of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin HaManoach, which was also the trigger for the founding of Tzohar, my husband and myself got engaged that day. That was not planned in advance, but this is how it happened. Why am I saying this? Because I remember back then, I was in my very early 20s, I remember going to the demonstration. We were afraid that Rabin is going to give away the Golan. And Na'akiva, you know, we were 80 kids in Na'akiva in our Shevet, right, our age group. I remember as, you know, young teens and then later on as young adults, we would all go to the demonstration. It was obvious. Everyone is against, you know, giving away the Golan. It's obvious. I don't think there was any exception. Even if there were people who were slightly thinking, you know, it was very clear that whoever goes to the Ulpana that I went to, whoever goes to Bnei Akiva, this is their hashkafa. Nowadays, I do not see things this way. I see more diversity. I'm exposed to more people who out loud say and express their opinions and yet find themselves affiliated with religious Zionism. The only problem is, and I think that there are two problems if I can pinpoint. A, I think there's a very big contrast between the public and the representatives of the public. I can say, because in my family, being the daughter of, this is not why I'm here, but I'm just saying this because this was brought up. I would have brought it up. Oh, you would have brought it up. But my father is the Minister of Science, and he heads the party called Bayit Yehudi. It's really not politically correct, and Bayit Yehudi is not left-wing, but it's not politically correct when it comes to Hanhaga, when it comes to leadership, especially when it comes to the expectations of the rabbinical world, of the political leadership. It's not politically correct to express moderate opinions which consider more than just the idea of Eretz Yisrael HaShlema. It's not politically correct, and immediately you're being referred to as, you know, Ocher Yisrael, and so on and so forth, and this may be Ocher Yisrael, the enemy.
A traitor.
Even if you yourself are right-wing, are against giving away parts of the land, are supportive of the settlement, but at the very same time, again, if you see that there are other considerations, and again, you're willing to think outside the box, and again, outside that framework, that is considered irresponsible, illegitimate, and again, so when it comes to the political discussion, I see that there is no willingness to accept anything but right-wing, the way Arutz Sheva views what right wing should be. That's one problem. And another problem, on a completely different level and completely different sphere, is how the non-religious world views religious Zionism. I'll provide you an example. It happened just this week. Because again, I'm in the academic world, so you get all those very boring emails, right? You know, people stir up a certain issue and then people start sending their opinions, and it's very long emails and you read through them and it's very tiring. And usually I don't even play along with this. I just see the emails and I just don't read them through. And now, I don't know how many of you have been acquainted I've heard of this, but about a week and a half ago, there was a big uprise because one of the judges in the Supreme Court in Israel, who's called Shofet Edmond Levy, who is Sephardi, is about to retire, and some academic people have come to the realization that of all the candidates who will replace him, there will be no more Sephardi representation in the Supreme Court. So they started this riot. They've sent, petition, thank you, I was looking for it, of a lot of academic representation asking that that they would nominate a judge that comes from the Sephardi world. And that stirred a lot of heated discussions. What is Sephardi now? If his grandmother is Sephardi and his father is Ashkenazi, would that work in our Israel today? This is a discussion that belongs to the 80s. This is not a whatever. And a lot of academic words were thrown into the air. And I'm reading through those emails, and all of a sudden I see a very intelligent person. I'm not going to even mention his name, but he's a very intelligent professor in Haifa University. And I actually worked quite closely with him. We were writing an article together about a year ago. And I see him writing, because one of the people was asking him, why won't we look for representation for Mitnachalim? Why won't we look for representation for Charedim? Why are you just so upset about representation for the Sephardim? So he said to him an answer to his claim. He was saying to him, with regards to representation of settlers, I am not worried, because I don't know how many of you know, but most probably there's going to be a new, this is a new thing, but there's going to be a new judge appointed, Shofet
Noam
Solberg, who lives in the Gush. So we're going to have a judge that is a Mitnachel. And also, he writes in, there's going to be a new religious woman who's going to be nominated as a judge. So she will represent the Mitnachalim. Now, I was very upset. If she's a religious woman, a Dati Lumi woman, is that an indication that she's a Mitnachelet? Or that by definition she will support the Mitnachalim in every Pesach Din that she will provide? So I wrote back and I said, what, anyone who's religious is to you automatically a settler? I said, if the common person would tell me this, that's one thing. But you are an academic, I would expect you to think outside the box. And that person provided me the most outrageous answer. He said, obviously I didn't mean it this way, he was apologetic, he understood, I mean, like, he knows I'm religious, so I didn't want to get you upset, but he said, I meant to say, and he said, admit it, statistically, most of you support the settlement. So I'm saying, when it comes to our leadership, our political leadership, yes, we definitely have a problem. Is it dangerous to be a political leader who thinks outside the box, who does not follow the path of what Gush Etzion or Gush Emunim initially had declared? Then I'm not sure whether it's dangerous, but it's definitely not easy. When it comes to the way we're viewed by others, that's also a very major issue. But within us, I think that there is that complexity. I think it does exist.
Okay, so we'll continue in those two paths. One, you, as I know, you're a good mother, and you ask your children, what did they learn in school today? Can you mention, when did they learn in school about peace, spoke about peace, desire to peace, and what's your opinion about that? That's one thing. From the other hand, as a wife of a rabbi, of a rebbetzin, you know the rabbis, do you remember ever that one rabbi of our society spoke about the desire for peace, and what occasions, and what are the conclusions of those speeches about droshes about peace?
This is a very big question, and as you're bringing it up, I'm trying to remember to myself.
I'm expressing opinions, don't worry.
Well, you're definitely expressing an opinion here. I'm trying to think of a specific case where any of my children had presented the idea of peace, they came from school and said, we've learned about peace today. And I can say it is non-existent. It doesn't happen. But at the very same time, I do not see them coming from school. And these were events that we had growing up, coming from school and saying Ha'ami Magolan or Ha'ami Mashtachim, or saying we're going to go to a demonstration from school. And we did. We had buses that took us from the Ulpana to demonstrations. This does not happen. My daughter is now 15 or 16 years old. That doesn't happen in her school, and she goes to an Ulpana, which I am sure was very politically involved in the past. So things have changed, but I do not see open discussions of our eagerness for peace. I do not see that happening. I do see some problematic statements from the schools, and definitely this is our role in our, you know, as parents to kind of, you know, we don't just rely on the education in schools regardless, but definitely in this field. I agree with you 100%, but there's an explanation for this. I mean, like, there's a reason for it, why it happened.
Yeah. Differently.
So what's the reason?
Explain.
No, you would
explain. No, no.
Okay.
You'll interpret it, and if I disagree, I'll get involved.
We have been pressed to the corner. Religious Zionism has been pressed to the corner. It was illegit, again. And at least, I mean, like, you open newspapers today, you hear the media, you hear the press, you open Ruth Stein during Chadashot, you hear the news broadcast. You see how the Mitnachalim are viewed as illegitimate. How the religious Zionist public is viewed as illegitimate. We all know what was the atmosphere after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And despite the fact that I can say with clear certainty, at least in the crowds that I'm acquainted with, people were shocked and appalled by the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. But we were all regarded, at least in some places, as potential murderers. So you're pressed to a certain corner. You feel that your ideology is at stake, so you need to enhance that ideology. And I think that no one had really sat down and thought of the price. But I can tell you, for example, I don't know how many of you know that the date of the old site of Yitzhak Rabin is Yud Aleph B'Cheshvan, which happens to be the old site of Yud Aleph or Yud Bet. Am I confusing
you? Yud Bet.
Yud Bet is Rachel. Happened. But I think he's Yud Aleph.
He's Yud Aleph. Rachel Imenu is Yud. No, the opposite. I don't know exactly.
I keep confusing.
I must know because 2 weeks ago it happened. 2 weeks ago, and my new granddaughter was born on Yud Aleph Cheshvan. So I have or Yud Bet. I even don't know that. So I have to figure out exactly.
We won't tell. Anyways, so if I'm not mistaken, the author of Ahal is Yud Aleph, and Rabin was assassinated on Yud Bet. Now that created a major issue for religious Zionist schools in Israel, because there was this expectation, if I'm not mistaken, it was also placed into the school curriculums that the school should be discussing the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. And I thought that is a very important thing to do. There's no difference between the assassination of Gedalia, which we also fast until today on Tzom Gedalia, and the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. It's a terrible thing that happened to Israeli society. But what happened was that along with that expectation, there was an expectation not just to talk about what this assassination did to the Israeli society, about the gaps, about the need for peace between us, but it became a day of Moreshet Rabin, right? The legacy of Yitzhak Rabin. Now, not all schools identify, and I'm understating this, by saying Moreshet Rabin. And many of us had many issues with Moreshet Rabin. I'm not even sure that it was a set Moreshet legacy. It became a Moreshet after his assassination, Achrei Mot Gershim Amor, right? So many schools had a big issue with that. So this is why Rachel became very popular. And all of a sudden, you see, in many schools, the mentioning of the Yahrzeit of Rachel, those of you who have children in Israel, most probably on Yud Aleph or Yud Bet B'Cheshvan, there's usually a parent teacher night or whatever, parent
girls.
Students night.
Especially girls.
Right, exactly, where they do a limud for in memory of Rachel Imenu. I think it's beautiful that we're remembering Rachel again, but it covers up for something. Now, I've been invited to 5 places to speak about Rachel Imenu. I actually have a show with a singer, we're doing this about Rachel Imenu. Why am I saying this? Because in all the places that I have spoken, I spoke of the legacy of Rachel Imenu and how that enables us to talk about the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and what that did to Israeli society. But I did it because I had that urge burning from within, not because any school asked me to do so.
Okay, so that's one. I asked 2 questions about the rabbis, too, and I'll add to this question. Can you name even one rabbi today in Israel from the Zionist religious movement? I mean, someone that is known that spoke about desire for peace in the last 10 years. One.
Now you're really putting me on the spot.
Menachem Fruman. Okay, that's right.
Nachon,
okay. Okay. First of all, Sheyeh Bari. We are neighbors and good friends. You're right. Okay, one. Second. Menachem Fruman is a unique person.
Very
really.
Unique.
He is a rabbi of Tekoa. He's very known in Israel. He is a kind of a tzaddik, really.
Very spiritual.
It's very spiritual. Has a lot of relationship with the Palestinians, with the Hamas, with whatever. And he says that peace will be achieved by religious leadership and not by politicians. Okay? And he really believes, and somehow everybody loves him. Okay? Everybody loves him. Even the people that are really opposed to his opinion. But he's unique. You can't, you know, it's you can't call him, you can't formulate him. Menachem Fruman is Fruman, okay? Now, let's add another name. No. We didn't speak about peace. I don't know, last 10 years, we're good friends. Didn't speak about peace. For the last 10 years?
Amital.
Also, 10 years, no. 10 years, I'm talking about last 10 years. I don't think.
Would you define what department by?
Doesn't matter. Saying the word, bring it as a topic. No, I'm not talking about peace between Jews. I'm not talking about peace between Jews, even though it's maybe more important. I'm talking with the Palestinians. You know what I mean. Peace is peace is peace. I'm not talking about the idea of the... Never. Never. He's not part of the. I don't know what he said, but he's not part of the leadership of the rabbinical world. And now I'm not asking. Okay, that's the. You see that we have to find someone. Mm-hmm. So my question is not the facts. The question is, and this is this session, what does it mean?
I'll tell you. I think I've heard this at a conference of Tzohar 2 years ago, the international conference that we held in the summer. Rav Sheinwald spoke. Amazingly, and he's from Modi'in.
He's the head of the Hezer Yeshiva in Modi'in.
And he said, you know what the
Sheinwald. He's a general in the army, in the reserves too, so he knows what he's
speaking
about.
He knows what he's talking about. And I don't remember what the discussion of the panel was about, but he spoke and he said, and I think that goes back to the comment that I mentioned a few minutes ago, he said, you know what the problem of many of our leaders is? If you want to be relevant, you need to look at your affiliation, you need to look at your people, and you need to say the right things. So he said, this is not leadership. This is like he was saying something very extreme. So it's like the caliph that goes, right, you know, you think the caliph is going ahead of you, but he's actually, he's not the boss. When it comes to junction, it looks back to see where the master is going. And we as leaders... I do not think are mastered by our people, because I think that the people, again, when it comes to the people, I feel that the people are looking for that leadership, are looking for a brave person who will come and say, listen, things are a bit more complicated than they're being presented. Again, I do not know what the right answer is. I just think that we, as the people, as religious Zionists, we need that complexity. We need to hear that complex message from our leaders instead of hearing black and white, you know, statements. But, again, when it comes to the political realm, the atmosphere, again, you will not be able to exist and function if you're making those statements. You feel that you will be drawn out of the, you won't be relevant anymore. You will be marginalized, right, exactly, as an extremist, as an... And likewise, again, in the rabbinical world itself, has its own, it's like a lachat chavrati, it's like social, it's like peer pressure. There's peer pressure. You cannot say things that are not, again, politically correct according to the mass.
Okay, so you personally was a part of a delegation, I can call it, that met with the Palestinians for 2 years.
Right.
So I'm asking two questions. First of all, in 5 minutes, give us a brief description what happened there. But the most, for this session, because I'm going to concentrate on our society, did you bring anything, benefits, back into the congregation, to the society that you went, from it, and did you bring any fruit from it back to Israel?
Okay, so very briefly, I will say I was invited to partake in track two, they call them, Israeli-Palestinian conversations that took place in Switzerland. This was initiated by an organization called Swiss Peace, which is a governmental organization that brought us Oslo and Geneva. They're all initiations of Swiss peace. The reason why I was invited, just to make a long story short, was that, again, after Oslo backfired, there was a realization of the Swiss peace organization that most probably they've done wrong. What they did is that they took very moderate Fatah representatives, they took very left-wing Israeli representatives, they put them in a room, and those two parties managed to agree on a lot of things. But they were not representing the Palestinian world, nor were they representing the Israeli world. So they decided to make it a bit of a wider representation. So they brought in a lot of more representation from the Palestinian side, including Hamas representation that came from not Gaza, but from the United States. And Lehavdil, they brought a lot more representation of the Israeli side, including right-wing representation. That happened for one workshop. They had one workshop with such representation. Because of the Chatham House rules, I am prevented from sharing the names of the people who were there. But I can tell you that they were ministers, they were parliament members, they were journalists, right-wing, hardcore right-wing representation in those conversations. But they had a problem in the first workshop where I did not attend, because one of the Hamas representatives, he holds a doctorate from Columbia. We shouldn't underestimate them. They know their stuff. He's a very intelligent, outspoken guy, but he also behaves like an imam. So what he would do is that once the workshop would begin, he would stand up. He would start quoting verses like an imam, you know, with his eyes closed. He would start quoting verses from the covenant between the pieces. And obviously he would change the verses so it may seem as if God had given up on the Jewish land, on the Jewish right for Israel, and whatever. And, you know, the Israeli delegation wasn't prepared for this, although many of the representatives were religious and learned. But, you know, you're not ready for it. So they asked the organizers to bring in one more person to add to the Israeli delegation, who will be a rabbi. So the Swiss, being very politically correct, agreed to it in condition that it's a woman. So this is how
Rabbi Pina.
Now, so I was addressed by a journalist that I know you know, but I cannot unveil his name. A very devoted person. He called me up and he asked me to join. And I said to him, I had a lot of second thoughts about this because I felt it's illegitimate. I never defined myself as a politician, but I hold, you know, I do have, I think, a mild right-wing ashkafa, but it was very hard for me to join. And he said to me, listen, we had Oslo because we refrained from joining such conversations and we created it as a reality. We were not aware of what's happening behind the scenes and we must be involved. So I agreed. Because I was prepared for this and because I heard about the behavior of this imam, so I did the exact same thing, meaning I memorized the covenant between the pieces. I memorized relevant psukim from the Tanakh, and I also memorized psukim from the Quran. I don't remember them anymore, so don't ask me to quote. But when this guy stood up, it was the first session, he stood up and he started quoting. I stood up, and I can behave like an imam. I stood up, and I started quoting verses back at him, and that stopped here and then. I mean, but it was a very big eye-opener. I attended such three workshops. And it was an eye-opener in various ways. A, because you realize that things were happening behind the scenes while we were involved in arguing and, you know, what Eretz Yisrael L'Shema is and demonstrating whatever. Things happen behind the scenes and it's intimidating to see. I can tell you that in such discussions I was presenting certain proposals. You know, you throw things in the air. And, you know, in the Palestinian delegation, you know, very intelligent people, they would say, Olmert offered us much more. This is nothing. This is already a given because Olmert offered us much more. So, and that was that's on a personal level, that was shocking to me. What was really interesting, and again, that goes back to your question, is that for the first time in my life, I had the realization that we're dealing with people, meaning it's people versus people. And although I cannot say that I had any sympathy for Hamas representation, they were beyond intimidating, but still you understand that the situation is complicated. And I'm not sure that I was exposed to that complexity before I had that experience.
So now I have my final questions before the audience can participate. I'm not sure I know how to express the question in English, so I'll try, and if not, I'll say it again in Hebrew, okay? Now, you mentioned by a comment that you are presenting with this girl singer. I know her very well because she's the wife of my dentist. And so I have, you know, all kinds of relationship with the family. Yeah. So therefore, a very interesting show. But am I right? It's not only for women.
No.
I mean, okay. Now, my question is the following. I'm not talking, first of all, say a few words about that. But my question is the following. In order to come to such a performance, you must be moderate from the religious point of view, because someone mentioned in the last a recent session about Kol Isha or whatever, okay? Now, do you see any connection between your opinions towards religion and your opinions towards the conflict between the Palestinians and us? So if you are moderate, you are moderate in those both fields, because that's your personality, or maybe it's your philosophy. And if you are extremists and you'll say it's not according to Allah and you can't take part of it, usually, at least statistically, we'll find you in the very extreme right wing in politics term. So first of all, do you agree with the facts? And did you understand my question? Second, do you agree with the facts? And third, what do you do with those facts? And I'm asking Rabbi Imam Pnina to answer this question.
I did not anticipate this question at all, but I will.
Okay. I didn't promise you to have an easy life.
Okay, so very briefly about this show I'm holding with a singer. It should be mentioned I'm not singing in that show.
Yeah.
I'm just speaking. I'm just speaking. This show is an initiation of the singer. She's called Chagit Kfir. She performs in that show along with two of her daughters who also
sing. She calls herself a cantor.
She's also a cantor. She is a cantor. It's amazing. It's this is the first time that I've been hearing a woman cantor.
I wasn't there. Okay, so I'm sorry. I wasn't there, but I heard that doing drilling in my teeth, I heard the type. Okay, so you can understand what is my emotional feelings towards this show.
I have to say that this was an initiation of Chagit. To be frank, she approached me with this initiation about 10 years ago, and I didn't even know what she's talking about. I didn't understand where she's heading with this. So it kind of, you know, she threw it up in the air, and I didn't know her. And it became a reality about 3 years ago. And yes, we have five separate shows. Each show stands by itself. It's a shi'ur. And she sings into that shi'ur, and it creates, I think, a very enhanced experience. For me, it's overwhelming. It opened me up to an experience that I did not anticipate that I would ever be a part of. I have to say that initially when we started it, it was a women's only show. And I would say that statistically, and I'm not being apologetic here, but 80% of our performances are aimed only towards women. But if we are invited to appear in front of a mixed audience, then we do agree. I have to say that it took me a while, and I'm not sure I agree with you that I'm moderate when it comes to halacha. It took me a while to agree to it, not because I thought that it was halachically problematic. I don't see any halachic problem with that, and this is, again, after I've researched into it. But because of the way that I thought it may be presented and maybe how people will, you know, view me. But at some stage in my life, I realized I don't care. So I agreed to it. I realized I don't care after I got almost bullied by a certain school called Chorev in Hanana, who claimed that I am very, feministic, very whatever. And they I don't think they know me. I don't think they've ever heard me. So I said, if people, you know, are already, you know, placing me in that direction, okay, so be it. I don't care anymore. But the reason why I agreed to it is, again, I'm not sure I would be able to sing in front of a crowd. I'm not sure I even have the good voice, as you can hear. But I know I don't have a problem speaking in front of a mixed crowd. And if Chagit has no problem singing in front of a mixed crowd, then obviously I'm not going to be the one who educates her. I do agree with you that it's not the bon ton, that it's not popular. And I find it very problematic that not just religious Zionism, but rather religious crowds in general it seems that the only appropriate thing is to prohibit kol beisha arva. But I think there's always a price. And again, things are complicated. Again, it goes back to that complexity. So it's of great concern to me that, again, I always say this, that if you're non-religious and you're opening a radio in Israel today, what do you hear of? You hear of soldiers coming out of a room when women soldiers dressed modestly sing as a part of a group.
Hatikva,
in front of a microphone. So halachically, there's so much to be makel here. So this is what you hear. You hear of the women poster signs in Yerushalayim that are being taken out, Adi poster signs, right, for the organ donations, right? Women their face cannot appear on both. And you hear of the separation of buses, and it kills me that this is what Judaism is about nowadays. I think that Judaism is a bit more complicated, and I think that we're not always aware of the price that's paid when we prohibit women's singing, when we prohibit women's placement on posters. Not that I think that it's ideal that women models are going to be on posters. Not that this is my passion in life, but I think that there's a price if you don't see women in the public sphere at all. And yes, so we lack, sometimes we do lack that complexity. And I agree with you that there is a connection or a correlation between the lack of complexity when it comes to our halacha and the lack of complexity when it comes to our political views. But I do not think that it's a clear-cut case, meaning that necessarily anyone who's right-wing is also very strictly
right-wing
when it comes to the halachic sense or vice versa. On the contrary, some of my best friends, as they say, right, are, you know. But I do think that what's missing is that lack of complexity. Yes, but I do think so.
Okay, audience, please participate in our chavrusa. First of all, you have... Okay, I don't know the name, so please, but please go to the microphone, okay?
Keep the questions brief, please. And,
with a question mark in the end, you know, and not.
I know that in some languages they put the question mark at the beginning. I think Spanish or something. What?
Inverse.
So my name is Menachem Mendel Meir Meister, Arba Memim. I live in Yerushalayim, Yir HaKodesh. And you mentioned before about which rabbis talk about peace. So I'm not suggesting that these rabbis necessarily do, with the exception of one. I'm asking the question. Rav Melchior, I think he speaks about peace, or he certainly used to, number one. Another rabbi who's not of the same stature is Rabbi Ian Pear of Shir Chadash in Yerushalayim. And the third one is a very good friend of mine, Rav Simcha HaKohen Cook, Chief Rabbi of Rehovot. Now, I understand he gives a radio show every week. I've never heard it, but I heard him speak personally to me about peace many times. Do you agree with those three names?
I don't want to deal with names, but it's a very good example to what I claimed through my questions. Rav Malkio is not a rabbi. He's a rabbi. I mean, I'm talking about the social point of view. You understand? He's not a rabbi of a congregation of the Zionist religious movement. The same thing is Rav Simcha Cook. Rav Simcha Cook is a very, very extreme Haredi rabbi. Don't make... it's right, he's the rabbi of the town of Rehovot. He's a great Talmid Chochem. I have a relationship with him. Sometimes we solve together problems of Agunot and Mesoravot Ket. So, but don't... You can't call him a rabbi of the Zionist religious movement. I'm talking... This crowd, and the name of the session is the Zionist religious movement. So therefore, if you had to find those names, I think it proves my facts. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Nina, it was interesting when you talked about your meeting in Geneva. You talked about, I was shocked to find out their story. And I think that and I'm wondering how you feel that the educational system of Israel should address the issue of the fact that so many of us don't know about what happened pre-48, the promises that were made to the other side. I'm not saying that Israel doesn't have a right to exist, but there is another story, and it's so. And I'm just wondering if you will address the issue of the importance of educating the Israeli population that there is another story, and in order to get to the peace table, if there is a possibility.
Okay, I should mention and clarify this. I think that for me, the eye-opening experience was not about understanding or being aware of the other story. but rather about seeing the people. Meaning, I was aware of the other story, and personally, I'm very involved in Beit Morasha. There's an institution called the Schwartz Institute. I don't know, Rav Sherl, if you're acquainted with it, and it's initiated by Dr. Moshe Hellinger.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very interesting guy. He's Haredi. Originally, he was Haredi, and he's very left-wing, very intelligent person. So I'm hearing the other story for a long while now. Moshe and I argue about this constantly, but I'm saying... What I meant to say, that for me, what was very interesting is about meeting the people, especially, again, Fatah representation, because you see that there are people, and they have their struggles, and they have their passions, and they have their ideas. At the very same time, I think it's very challenging to bring that into the schooling system, and I'll say why. I think that one of the problems of Israeli society today, and again, it's complicated. One of the problems of Israeli society today is that if you take the average person who's center, you know, nowadays they say there's no small and there's no yamin, there's no right and there's no left. People are in the center. Kadima is not much different than the Avodah, not much different than Miflaget Atzmaut, not much different than Likud, right? Everyone is the center. But you ask the person, and people just want peace and quiet. People want peace and quiet. This is what they want. And I think it was very devastating to me yesterday, listening to the panel, was very devastating. Because even those who are passionate supporters of peace and quiet have no good solution for how you reach that goal. Why am I saying this? Because people are so eager to just have tranquility in their lives that I do not feel that people are passionate anymore about their own tradition, about their own heritage, and about what initially they're fighting for. I'll say this in other words. I think people are willing to give up Hebrona because they view the settlers as very problematic people, but they don't know who's buried in Ma'arat Machpelah. And they don't know what Ma'arat Machpelah represents to the Jewish nation, especially after Parashat Chayei Sarah. So I'm saying this is an ongoing, very heated debate in Israel right now, what you should add into the school curriculum and what you should not. Should you share the narrative of the other nation or should you not? And again, narratives are not necessarily true stories. They're not necessarily facts. So that's very problematic. But I'm saying, and again, I'm not sure this is an answer to you because I do think that we should bring our children, raise our children with more complexity. I think we should stress our eagerness for peace. I think we should say that shalom is a Jewish value, not just amongst us, but rather as world peace. But at the very same time, I think that what the school curriculum should enhance is understanding our narrative before we understand others. And I feel that nowadays, also in the religious Zionist world, I think people don't understand our narrative. They don't understand where we're stemming from.
Okay. Wait, 1 minute. Okay. So, no, we promised her, and okay.
Thank you. I have to say, it sounded very interesting. I thought Rabbi Shlomo's questions were very interesting and thought-provoking, and Professor Nywert, you're very articulate, and your view. I think the message here is about open dialogue, active listening, respectful conversation between all groups, and I wish more people felt that way. The thing is, though, I feel this title is something of a misnomer because I thought kind of that this would be an optimistic kind of view about the Jewish dream of peace. And I'm just wondering if perhaps you could end on a positive note and tell us a little bit that there is a Jewish dream of peace out there today. Is it possible? Does it exist?
Before Pnina's answers, I want to say one thing. You know, when you come to a session, you usually speak about the things that are not obvious. Because to speak about the obvious things, nobody will come and nobody will be interested. Mm-hmm. I think that we got new all kinds of aspects. No, I'm telling my... Okay, so therefore, whenever I speak in a session, I'm trying to inspire, to energize, to bring, to think out of the box and to raise the problems, not the regular issue. Now, no doubts about the fact that peace is a Jewish value. We say it so many times through our praying. we really don't have the tradition of trying to have a jihad or even not to a missionary a mission in order to take all the Gentiles and make them Jews or whatever. This is not our tradition. Our tradition is the desire, the passion for peace. This session, at least from my point of view, that was to try to think why there is such a big gap between our prayers and our visions and our dreams and our the things that we read in Tanakh about shalom and etc. and reality of education, of society, of culture, of art, of arts and whatever. So therefore, we didn't give now a seminar about peace in Judaism. We spoke about all kinds of, from my point of view, all kinds of aspects. But actually, you're right. I think that, like we, in the last sentence of this session, exactly like every tefillah, we'll say, "Oseh shalom bimromav, u'yaseh shalom aleinu v'al kol Yisrael." That's the last sentence in every kaddish, in every tefillah, in every. Okay, that's you're right. But in order to inspire the people here, we decided to raise the problems.
I would say, in continuation to this, I will just say very briefly, it seems to me that the general public in Israel, meaning I'm generalizing and saying datim, chilonim, smolanim, ashkenazim, sfaradim, yemanim, whatever, everyone, we're all now at a very crucial junction. I think that there is an atmosphere of disappointment in the air, and wherever you at the political map, you're disappointed from something. If you're a left-wing, you're disappointed from Oslo and Geneva and whatever backfired. If you're right-wing, you're disappointed with the disengagement and with your own government being willing to take people out of their houses and out of the settlements and whatever. So there's a general feeling of disappointment, and I think that many people are now standing and asking themselves, our agenda, what we truly, honestly, sincerely believed in, has it been successful? Maybe we should re-examine and ask ourselves again, maybe we should take a different path. I hear this amongst religious and non-religious people, amongst left and right wing representations. And I think that that by itself is an optimistic message. Why? Because out of this disappointment, I think that a lot of good can come out. I think that now the Israeli society has no choice but to re-examine itself. And I think that that includes also the religious Zionist sector. I think that we have reached certain points where we have no choice but to make those decisions. I think that now a lot of leading rabbeim, I don't know if you'll agree with me or not, but I think that people do feel the urge, meaning the questions that you have brought up. I hear those questions. I do not hear a rabbi coming and saying we should talk about peace, not that we should, again, be supportive of, we should talk about peace. I hear that question being presented. And I think that in the coming few years, this is my anticipation, this is my expectation, I think that we will be exposed to different forms of leadership of religious Zionism that we haven't been exposed to until now. This is how I view it.
Hi, thanks for informing us so much. You mentioned, Penina, that when you came away from the conference in Switzerland, you had a new appreciation for the complexity and for the fact that, you know, you were the other side was people. I'm just wondering, during your three sessions at that conference, did you witness a willingness on the Palestinian side, either Hamas or Fatah, to really listen to our side of the story and to walk away on their side with seeing us as people and seeing the complexity? Because I think that one constant that I just see as an observer and a reader of different articles is that the one constant has been their unwillingness to hear our side of the story. And Yossi Klein Halevi came to Toronto not long ago, or a few years ago, and that was his new realization, that they are not willing to listen to our side of the story. And recently, Carolyn Glick wrote an article, and she was saying that the Israeli Dati Lumi, she sees that that point of view really does have a stronghold in the Israeli public to a degree because of their disillusionment, but there's no voice in the general media for them. And the media is still pretty much controlled by the left-wing point of view. And so she was asked, when there's a question, like, why is there still government policies that reflect policies more of the left wing, it's because of their lack of public voice of the more Dati Lumi point of view.
Before Pnina answers, I want to say make two comments. It was a very good question, but we'll divide two parts of it. The first part about the Palestinians, I prefer that the answer will be very short because this session is about the Zionist religious movement, and we spoke last night about the negotiations, about the Palestinians or whatever, so it's a very good question, but I prefer that we'll... You know, I'm a teacher, and as a teacher, I'm trying to... Even though there are many questions, I'm trying to go to use the spine of the session, and the second question is a very good one and very relevant to this session, and that is the appearance of the Zionist religious ideology, and we have Amiel Unger here that can give a better answer than us about this issue, and I'll ask Pnina to make her answer wider about this issue.
Of representation, yeah, of religious Zionism in the media.
In the media. And I'll say a few words.
So very briefly, with relation to your first question, I will say very briefly three things. It's very complicated. It was very interesting. We should really distinguish between Fatah and Hamas. What happened was that the first session we had, it was an introductory one. Everyone was, you know, the microphone was passed around the table and everyone represent, not, we all had our mics, but anyways, everyone presented themselves and said where we're coming from and what their expectation from the workshop is, like they do in every workshops, right? And everyone was very positive, including Fatah representatives. Everyone was very positive. I said, I've come to learn, I've come to listen, I've come to present my case. You know, you got pretty much that same answer. When it came to the Hamas representatives, they said, we have come to tell you that there's nothing but a one-state solution, and that state is going to be Palestinian. If you want to join it, that's beautiful. If not, you can go to the ocean, and this is what we've come to say. Now, when you hear that at your face, in the beginning of a workshop, that's like, whoa, it was shocking. But I was very appreciative of the fact that they were very frank and not disguising what they think. Having said that, I will also say that Hamas turned out to be, at least they wanted to be, my best friends. Because if you remember what I said before about this imam getting up and starting quoting verses from the Quran and the Torah, stood up and, like they say, Majnun, right? He started quoting verses from the Torah. They kept on, it was terrible. The first workshop, they kept running after me. Tell us more about your religion, about your practices, because they kept on telling me, you are our worst enemy, but you understand us most. This is how they viewed me. The third thing, and again, there's much more to say about this, but I'm very brief, as Rav Shalo had said, and I agree with him 100%. The third thing is about Fatah representation. On one hand, I saw some sincerity and willingness and openness. Some representatives were very highly educated, very intellectual, very impressive. Many of them were Christians and not Muslims, and that made a very significant difference. People who simply want a normal, pragmatic life. But at the very same time, those people, when it came to making decisions, again, in that workshop, and I'm not talking about deciding to divide Jerusalem, I'm talking about stupid decisions like we agree that both religions have the right to practice their religion in the holy places, something of that sort. With no practical implementations, Fatah representatives, who just a minute ago said they're willing, they're open, they would say, okay, we need to make a phone call. They would get out of the room. They would, you know, all of them, for 30, 40 minutes, they would come back and say, we cannot agree. So there was a very big gap between the way they presented themselves on a personal level and what they were willing to say as, again, representing their people. So I don't know if that answered you, but I'm just saying it was very, very complicated. Excuse me? Oh, yeah. With relation to the second question, this is definitely not my field of expertise. Mamashlo. I agree 100% that, and this is, again, one of the sources of frustration, because our sector is frustrated by the fact that it has no voice. It has no voice in the Beit Mishpat, in the court. It has no voice in, or at least this is how people sometimes view it, and I think that it is accurate in the Prokletut, meaning in the public prosecution, has no voice in the Mishtara, in the police. Does have a voice in the army, but some people feel that at least when it comes to the leadership of the army, again, there's not enough representation. But most, first and most, has no representation in the media, and that voice is not heard. And statistically, that is correct. I have to say, but again, I'm not a media person. I'm not a media person, but it is very frustrating to hear of how things are presented when you open up, you know, the main broadcasting news at 8 o'clock in the evening, and that is a source of frustration, and maybe that triggers and generates all the phenomena that we've been speaking about today.
I want to say, in addition, something completely different. And I think that the fact that we are not on the media is because we decided not to be there. We decided years ago, and now things are being changed, but it will take time. Because we educated, first of all, I'll give you five examples, and I'll make it very briefly. First of all, we decided to educate our children to go to be teachers, to work in education, to go to the army. We didn't say a word of going to the media and trying to encourage them to do that. So we didn't, no new generation in the media grew up. That's one. So that's a result of our decisions. Second, as rabbis, we decided that we have to give long shiurim. The media doesn't have the patience for us. They want a question and an answer 1 minute and 40 seconds. Now, if you are willing, and 1 minute and 40 seconds is a lot in the media, okay? So if we feel that unless we are starting from Bereshis and giving the whole picture, like we give it Rosh and Shul, and it's too long, so therefore, and we are not capable to work in the media. So if you want to be in the media, you must adopt this skills. Those skills and those instruments. That's the second. Third, again, I'm talking about my world, about Rabbi's world. Working or being in the media, you must first of all realize and accept the fact that someone that thinks different from your side will be in the same tochnit, in the same program. And we are used to stand by ourselves and not to be criticized, not to be even, people are not laughing at us. Maximum, they're falling asleep. And then at least we did something good. Okay, that they have good dreams, I hope, and whatever. But if we want to be exclusive and not understand the language, the discourse in the media, it's a kind of a decision that we are not there. Four, we, and I can say the whole right wing, preferred to open a different channel, like Arut Sheva, like Nekuda, okay? Because this was the situation, and the price is that we have a voice, but nobody listens, because Arut Sheva or Nekuda or Israel, whatever. If we want to be in the media, we have to go to the center and to have failures, and to agree to have failures. And okay, that's four. Five, and I say it from my personal experience, being in the media means also failures. Okay? And sometimes you say nasty, stupid things. You know, you're under pressure, all the lights, and you have 40 seconds, 30 seconds to say something, and you said something wrong. Now, if it's someone else, a reporter, so he said something wrong, tomorrow is a new day. But you come to shul. And you there get it from your colleagues and from here and from there. So if we will not support our people that agree to go to the media to make also mistakes, so the conclusions will be, why should I go? Why should I represent it? And these are only five examples. I can give a list of 20, of 30. So in addition to what Pnina said, that the media is left-wing, I'll add the sixth one, and that is the media today is less lefty than, I'll say it, the only thing that the media is really interested in is a good story. Is a good story. So if you bring a good story, it will be in the first and on the headlines. But we hate the system because we claim, as an ideological movement, that the story is not so important. If it doesn't really represent something that has any value, so it's even a scene to advertise the story that is an exception and not deal with the major issue. Now, if we will not understand that this is the media language, so therefore we have to work at least partly with the media instruments, and that is to bring good stories, so we lose. So what I want to say, instead of blaming the whole world that they are making us to be silent and that they are isolating us and they're not giving us the opportunity, first of all, let's ask ourselves, what mistakes or what decisions that we made in the past and that actually are throwing us out of the media. Let's first of all fix them, and let's adopt the right skills and the right instruments in order to be in the media. And you can see it now that many religious Zionists, youngest, are having very important positions in the media. Some of them must become more moderate. You know, these are the rules. So let's play, first of all, according to the rules, and not decide that we'll open Arut Sheva and we'll continue to scream that nobody listens to us.
Two-part question. First of all, referring to Rabbi Riskin, I think that most people in this room who heard Rabbi Riskin over the years would have said that he was speaking very much about peace. So if he hasn't been speaking about peace over the last 10 years or so, do you have any idea in terms of why? I don't mean the evidence, I mean in terms of what might be the reasons why he has shifted off that. And the second part, especially in terms of chinuch, because of my involvement here with chinuch, I had the opportunity a few years ago in Eretz Yisrael to go to two schools that I think are chiloni schools, Beit Sefer Reali in Haifa, and Herzliya Gymnasia on Rechov Jabotinsky in Tel Aviv. I was very interested to go into some of the classes. There was a civics class, I think this was in the school in Tel Aviv, in Herzliya Gymnasia, and they were speaking about very much understanding the Palestinian viewpoint. I thought it was a little bit much in terms of going overboard almost in terms of that direction. I am wondering, on a practical level, from the religious Zionist aspect, can you make a sort of quid pro quo within the field of education, within Mizrat HaChinuch, in terms of let's have some more balance? You learn a little bit more in terms of your identity, in terms of Yiddishkeit, and perhaps and we perhaps can be much more open in terms of seeing and understanding what it must be like in terms of the other side.
So I'll refer to the second question. I don't know how many of you are acquainted with the latest discussions that it seems that the current Minister of Education is trying to kind of change the school curriculums again to enhance more of exposure of our teens, of our youth, of our kids to our tradition. I have to say that I, being involved with education, I visit many schools. I've been to both schools that you've mentioned, and I've been to other schools, both in peripheral areas and in the center of towns, like in the center of Anana, very good schools and schools which deal with more challenging issues. And overwhelmingly, a phenomena that I've been exposed to is the fact that many of our kids are completely ignorant when it comes to their tradition. Again, it seems like I'm bad-mouthing, and again, this is going back. We've had this discussion before. We're raising issues here. That does not mean that the situation is only black and terrible. And obviously, Baruch Hashem, there's so much beauty and so much willingness to contribute and so much passion. And I think that the Israeli youth is wonderful and innovative and very successful in many fields. But when it comes to their Jewish heritage and tradition, there are many historical reasons for this. But there's a lot of ignorance. People don't know their stuff. People don't know their stuff because, again, Jewish tradition was usually identified with religion. So you have to be religious in order to know your tradition. And if you know your tradition, that means that you're a dosi. You know your religion. You're religious. So therefore, there's a lot of animosity, and people don't want to learn, again, about the background and about their heritage. And I guess that creates a one-sided solution because, again, in many schools, it's very politically correct to learn the narrative of the other side. But at the very same time, there's not much awareness of our own narrative. And it seems as if, you know, we're open-minded. We bring one mitnachel to come to our school and tell us the narrative of the mitnachalim. But it's not their narrative. We're talking about the narrative of the Jewish nation. And is there a narrative? And I'm not sure that for many of us, there is a defined and a distinct narrative. I think things are changing, not just because of the initiation of Sar HaChinuch. I feel things are changing because there is a very interesting trend, a very interesting change that the whole secular public in Israel is undergoing currently. There's more need and quest to be closer to tradition. There are many examples for this. You see this both in the media. You see this in, for example, take the culture. So many singers. I could just name, what's his name from T-Pex, Eti Ankri, Beri Sacharov, Shlomo Grunich, so many Kobi Oz, that was T-Pex. So many singers that are very popular, very, very, very hip and trendy, and are singing Ibn Gavirol's poems and are getting back to a tradition. I'm not even talking about all the Banai kids who are slowly becoming more. So, and that reflects, that is a reflection of what the society is undergoing. I can tell you that I personally have been involved in many, many projects where you see batei midrash for non-religious pupils in schools that are opening, and this is a new phenomenon that was non-existent for over 60 years. So there's much more openness to learn. And I do agree, and that goes back to the comment that I have made before. It is important to know that there's another side. But I do think that we need to define to ourselves what our narrative is, again, what our story is, what our tradition is, what is our connection to those places, why are we really in this a struggle for peace, and where are we heading in that? And one more comment, and with this I shall end. That also applies to religious schools. In other words, another issue that I'm very concerned with, and this is maybe something that, Rav Shlomo, you were talking about, the fact that we kind of turned our back towards the media. I am not sure that many of our kids, but again, obviously there's more to do, but I'm not sure that they could present a case. I'm not sure that many of our kids, you know, could just, and I guess that is an issue that is the global and international, it's not just in Israel. But I think that because we are now in a struggle, I think that we need to provide more tools and skills for our average teenage kid, wherever he or she may be, that they will be able to sit and present a case and say, this is our agenda, this is our ideology, this is where we're heading from, this is our starting point, and these are our aspirations. So there's a lot of work to do.
I'll make one comment about Rav Rizkin, not personally, because I feel that I'm talking about him, but I'm talking about myself. And that is, I think that our schedule, our agenda, is packed. Because Rav Rizkin deals with agunot, mesoravot get, with being a rabbi of a town, with education questions, with questions that are related to open a new beit din ledinei mamonot, to solve, you know, the schedule of a rabbi in Israel, probably also here. And we didn't talk about conversions. We didn't speak about car accidents, and we didn't speak about all those issues that rabbis, and about organ donations that Rav Rizkin is very involved. And actually, I'm speaking about myself, so I don't want to speak about Rav Rizkin. That is, and the fact that the peace process is actually stuck, okay, in the last 10 years. So therefore, it's obvious that we'll hear Rav Rizkin on all the variety of issues, and peace will somehow blend in his words. And so, and you really didn't hear him about peace for years. Okay, that's the situation. Now, as we promised, we'll not say Kaddish in the end of this session, but I think that the right thing to say is Aseh Shalom Bimromav, U'Yaseh Shalom Aleinu, V'Al Kol Yisrael. Let's say all of us, Amen.